This is Tax Chats. Hello, I'm Scott Dyring.
And I am Jeff Hoops.
And we're here to chat
about taxes.
Hello again, and welcome to another edition of Tax Chats. I'm Scott Dyring, professor of accounting at Duke University, and I am joined, as always, by my friend and colleague at the University of North Carolina and curator of the Tax Museum, Jeff Hoops. Hello, Jeff.
Hello.
How's it going in the Tax Museum today?
So fine. It's going
all right. Anything exciting happening over there or not really?
There's always something exciting happening at the Tax Museum.
It is a tax museum, so I'm sure that is definitely true.
But, we're recovering from our post-filing deadline celebrations that we had.
Yes. Today is April 17th, and the Tax Museum, I'm sure, had a very busy day on April 15th.
Banners and balloons and confetti and everything else.
I'm sure that is true. Probably all virtually created on Jeff's computer screen would be my guess. Jeff, what are we doing today on Tax Chats?
So we have with us Partho Shom. Partho, do you want to introduce yourself?
Thank you for inviting me. I am Partho Shom. I was earlier tax policy chief at the IMF. I was also a visiting senior fellow in the London School of Economics. I was there in the tax program as well as the International Inequalities Institute. In India, I was a minister at one point. I'm currently also a member of the eminent persons group at Tax Notes International and founder chairman of a research organization, ITRAF, in Bangalore, India.
So tell us a little bit about when you said I was a minister. What is that? Like, you weren't like a religious minister, obviously. So what is a minister?
I know a minister is different in the UK, US, and India. A minister is a secretary in government in the US. That I was minister of state, which is assistant secretary.
And so at the federal level, over like all, or I guess maybe not, they didn't use that term in India, but over all of India.
Yeah, all of India. Correct.
And so how many steps removed were you from the head of all India? I don't even know. I think it might be a president.
One step.
Prime minister.
No.
One step.
Prime minister, then finance minister, and then minister of state.
So pretty high.
Sorry?
You were a big deal. Okay.
Jeff is only one step removed from the CEO of the Tax Museum. No, actually, he is the CEO of the Tax Museum.
I am the CEO. Zero step.
So that's as high as Jeff has reached. He's climbed only that high. Yeah. Very good.
So there, I mean, you obviously have had a super, super interesting career with a lot of experiences. We could talk about a lot of very, very, very fascinating things. But we have come to talk about something maybe unexpected, given all the many different things roles you played. We would like to talk a little bit about tax resistance in India, especially in the kind of colonial area. And you have a paper published on this and know something about it. So can you just kind of tell us a little bit about kind of Indian history and what taxes were like under British rule in India to kind of set the stage for how the Indians fought against it?
Tax regime in British India cannot be really eulogized in any way. In fact, you have to contain yourself while reporting on it, while talking about it. But basically, the British started as traders through the East India Company in 1757. And won a battle in Bengal. And then before that, they had trading rights, but they won a battle by taking advantage of the internecine rivalry among the Nawabites. The Nawabs were the kings there. And then they started a regime, basically, of extracting from the royalty whenever they... within the first 10 years, they changed the royalty three times. And every time there was a huge extraction for instating the new royal person. And that money was collected by East India Company. And then
East India Company kind of on behalf of the British government, or what relationship?
At that time, they had to transfer a certain amount of to the British government, but not everything. And they therefore had fat salaries for themselves and returns, but they did pass on a good chunk to the British. For example, at one point, they were passing, in nominal terms, £400,000 per annum. So that would be, let's say, $500,000 per annum at that stage. And this was, you know, in the 1700s. So a huge amount of transfer to the crown. But at the same time, they kept huge amounts themselves. So you can imagine.
What gave them the ability to do that? I mean, why would a company be able to not only change who the royalty of India is, but also like get money from them? Why don't the royalty just say like, no, you're just a company?
Yeah, one of the things was that they kind of paraded as a trading company, and while they paraded as a trading company, they were actually militarized somewhat by the crown. In fact, they were given the original permission by Elizabeth the First, whom we all adore and admire in films. And so they started, and their influence grew, and they superseded the other colonial powers at that time, whether it's be Portuguese or Spanish or French or Dutch. And they were very dexterous about how they were. And when they came to India, it was not very difficult, because they entered through a village in the east of India, in a very fertile area. There was a lot of internecine rivalry between the Nawab and his... The Nawab was a just 16-year-old young fellow who was still not adult in thinking. His general, the general's brother-in-law, and then the reinstatement of the general, and then the son of the general, and so on and so on and so on. And every time the British extracted a big amount and got special rights to collect tax on salt, on tobacco, on there was a variation of tobacco habit called betel nuts. And then as their power grew, they got even higher collecting powers from the Mughal emperor from Delhi. First was the Nawab of Bengal, which was a big district, not district, a big province. And then from the center, from Delhi, the Mughal, who was the emperor, and there they got the right to collect taxes from the provinces of Bengal, Bihar, and Orissa, which were extremely fertile areas. So there, and the interesting thing is that all of this happened within the first 50 years of their being there. And before one realized, within the first 20 years, Bengal frankly went into ruin. A very fertile area, with the early observers from the West who came from Europe and Britain and so on, they all wrote how sort of the people were nourished, it was extremely fertile, the fields were green and so on. And within 20, 25 years, and certainly by the end of 50 years, the whole place was full of famine. People died almost every decade. There was a famine because the extraction was too heavy. And so first was the land revenue extraction, and then the rights to collect taxes from commodities. So there was a rapid fall. And because they agreed to pass a certain amount of money, huge amount of money to the crown every year, they had to meet that goal despite the fact of the general the reduction in soil and people, etc. And so
it wasn't a tax based on incomes, which would be great. If your income's low, then you pay little in tax. They had some quota, and so no matter what, they had to pay some amount, which would have made them kind of do things that were negative for society. So I do think it's interesting. So you talked about the different kinds of taxes. None of them appear to have been income taxes. They were all incomes on like commodities. So tell us a little bit.
Taxes on commodities.
Taxes on commodities. like SALT and other things. Tell us a little bit more about more. Why did they choose that as a tax base? And then, like, how did that work?
Yeah. Firstly, just to tell you, Jeff, that, you know, the it was not a direct income tax, because income tax was really still not in vogue, even in Europe and or in the U.S., And
What year are we talking about right
revenue,
now?
We are talking about the second half of the 1700s and the early 1800s. So, land revenue was what most tax collection was based on, which was in a way income based, because it depended on the value of the annual crop, which the British changed to not just the crop, but a certain amount of magnitude, because they had to meet the £400,000 goal. So that went from an income base, production income base, the total amount of crop and so on, to just somehow you have to give the money. And the responsibility of that was given to the Nawab, and who couldn't meet it. So this last fellow literally ran away, escaped, and died in poverty when the British actually took over the whole operation. So so it was land revenue mainly, and excises. They were also collecting points for they put up customs points. And they, in fact, interestingly, they put up, as I recall, about a 2,500-mile customs wall. It was a wall of thorns, which was built from the northwest rivers to the southeast rivers. And they
you couldn't pass it without paying some kind of fee or paying some kind of tax.
Yeah.
A wall of thorns.
Yeah, you couldn't cross, and you could only come to certain customs points and pay tax at those points. So there was no way you could cross that line without paying the tax. And at one point, the entire the governors general were installed, and they were surrounded by these thorn bushes, which no one could cross. Western observers said this is the most remarkable construction tax administration, because it's an impenetrable
wall of thorns. Technology, the wall of thorns. So I do think, so I completely get how if you build a wall of thorns and won't let anybody pass until they pay a tax, you can collect taxes. How was let's talk specifically about the salt tax, because it becomes important later in the story. How was the salt tax administered? Like, how do you make sure people pay taxes on salt when I could just go to the ocean, boil some water, and have salt?
Yeah, exactly. Good question, because that was forbidden. That became illegal. No one.
So boiling is illegal.
Yeah, you could not go to the sea or the lakes and make salt. And
some places with evaporation, you could just like scrape off the top layer of sand and have salt. You couldn't do that. So it's literally free on the ground. Don't touch it.
Thousands of inspectors and remember that this way salt became resulted in 10% of the total revenue collected. So you can imagine, out of all this huge amount of revenue, the role of salt and the increasing role of salt. And there was no possibility. In fact, when we talk about further about salt tax and what Gandhi did, etc., I won't tell that story beforehand. But it was just impossible. And the punishment for breaking these instated laws was so extreme that people just shied away. As a result, in fact, India, which produced a lot of salt, became an importer of salt from Liverpool. So basically, it became impossible to produce. Of course, it was not just salt, but even textiles and other things were banned from production.
So is this just an example of anytime you tax something, you get less of it and as a result, they were forced to import. Is that why the imports started happening? Because the tax was too burdensome and they couldn't produce enough?
Because salt, Indian produced salt became prohibitively expensive because for the common people, the buying Indian salt, for which there would be no reason, had become extremely expensive. So whereas Liverpool...
Was the foreign salt not subject to the same excise tax?
No, in England, they had their own tax regime. Because this is... Remember that the regime in India was the East India Company first, and then from 1857, 100 years after the 1757 original war of Plassey, when the Nawab, et cetera, took place, 100 years later, the Crown took over the direct administration of India. Till that time, it was the East India Company on behalf of the Crown. So once Britain had its own system of taxation, which was quite distinct from that of India. And throughout, even when the Crown took over the administration of India, and India became the jewel of the Crown, there was a very good reason why, because the extension of extraction was many more times. And so...
Was the tax on the salt levied on the producer or on the consumer? Who actually remitted the salt?
The consumer, basically, and also the producer that got the right to auction salt. But even that stopped because the government took over the right to auction. And after, at the auction point, the government collected tax from those who got the right to auction. And then the sellers had to sell salt and collect tax and pay to the government.
Okay, here's a question I never thought of before. Is salt important for Indian cuisine? How important is this ingredient in an Indian food?
At some point I had read that, when salt came into being, human beings never had salt until some point, not so far back into history. But by the way, the French have had a salt tax since maybe the 1200s in the 13th century, late 13th century.
Wasn't it true that salt was like really important for just preserving foods and other things? Like Jeff's thinking of, I got to put
and the tanning process, and you use salt in a lot of things.
Preservative and so on. So it was
particularly before the age of refrigeration. Like if you didn't have salt, you had no way to preserve food. And so it was sort of important for survival.
Although, what kind of food are you thinking of preserving, Scott?
Meat. Hang on. So Indians don't eat a lot of meat.
Especially historically.
What else do you preserve with salt? Do you preserve vegetables with salt?
Pickles.
No, you pickle vegetables with salt, and that is absolutely essential, some salt. But not too much salt, because then that would liquefy the pickle. You don't want that.
Not too much. I see.
Yeah.
So,
it was an essential commodity. People by then were very used to using salt.
So this led to like a march, the salt march.
Yeah. So let's move forward like 100 years. There's a salt tax. People don't all sorts of other commodities, but salt gets a lot of press. So what happened? What was the resistance? What happened to?
Salt was a very visible, essential commodity, and the Indian populace had been already feeling for decades deprivation from salt. And so Gandhi, who was an extremely intelligent man, and the amount the of salt tax was being continuously increased. So he identified that as an instrument that would be visible and might have an impact. So what all he did was in early 1930s, he just walked from his retreat in Gujarat, the state of Gujarat. At that time, it was a part of the Bombay presidency, to the sea to a place called Dandi. And there he just walked into the shores of the sea and picked up a handful of salt. And that had an electric effect all over.
You don't have to consume it. You literally just have to pick it up.
Yeah. And he just went to with about 70 to 80 people. And of course, I must say, at the same time, this same action took place on the same day in the east of India. Gandhi was in the west of India, in the east of India, in the city or town of Midnapore, where the another man called Sushil Dhar, he led about 1,000 people and went on the salt march. But he also belonged to the Congress Party.
So that was coordinated. I mean, they coordinated.
I think it must have been coordinated because both of them belong to the same party. And but I don't know, frankly, at this time that whether it was really that coordinated or not. But it must have been. It was the same.
It was before the days where they could just text each other to coordinate. So they had to. They had to have written some letter with a wax seal or something like that.
So they did something that was illegal.
Yeah.
It was illegal just to even pick up the tax because exactly. It was untaxed salt. So did they get put in jail or what happens as a result of their...
Of course, they were immediately taken to jail, etc. But the all of India started making salt in the house, outside, and so on. So the colonial masters then started arresting people, and it all led to about 100,000 arrests, which was impossible to
100,000?
Yes. And in India, numbers like that are not too high, even at that time, but even in 1930. But the thing is that, so there was a huge revolt, in a way, non-violent. And not only in West India and East India, but even in Northwest India, what is in Pakistan to the Northwest Frontier Province, there was another man, Khan Abdul Ghaffar Khan, who also belonged to the Congress, more of the Congress way of thinking. He started the same thing. He refused to pay tax. He started his own administration. Then the British sent the Gurkha Regiment. The Gurkha Regiment, they are from the Nepal, that area, and they are supposed to be very ruthless. And even today, the British revered them in a way because they could be utilized willy-nilly, quite ruthlessly. So the
utilized Gurkha, in a way that they could enforce the law. They were like the hired thugs to enforce the law.
The tax law. Don't tax the soul.
The tax law. We actually had this debate in the United States not too long ago whether or not the Internal Revenue Service had guns, but the British, they just got these people to come in and be the enforcement mechanism.
Yes, they were the enforcers. And the Gurkhas came and stopped it. But so in other words, there were various areas where leaders were doing the same thing around the same time. But the impact all over India, as I said, was electric because people started making salt, etc. Then the arrests could not be managed, and therefore the British authorities began because Gandhi, among all these leaders, was the leader. So he was invited to come for chats, and including to London. And but that really wasn't very helpful. Leave alone at that stage in the early 30s, talk of independence or anything, that really the British just kept inviting them to Delhi and then to London, etc. But he came back empty-handed. So many of his colleagues in the Congress Party, which is the party, were sort of... They didn't understand what Gandhi was doing, but they never really questioned him openly. And that went on. So in fact, very soon thereafter, that salt tax was again increased. And
they're going to double down.
Double down.
And not only that, at that time, there was a, in Punjab, again in the Northwest, You know the Sikhs. There are a lot of Sikhs in the US and Canada as well, but UK has a lot of Sikhs. It was a state or the province of the Sikhs, the British took an inexplicable action because a non-violent demonstration was taking place in an enclosure with a very small exit. And this brigadier called Dwyer, he sent in his troops, and there was something like 300 deaths in gunfire and more than 1,000 injured.
The protest that involved the 300 people was about taxes specifically, about colonialism?
Taxes. Yeah, about taxes. And, you know, the thing is that by that stage, it was all revolt against taxes. It was revolts linked up slowly and increasingly for the Quit India movement. It was called the Quit India movement. And soon thereafter, actually, Gandhi published a Declaration of Independence, which was very important because it was, the title was the same as in the United States. But and that said, at this point, for the first time, at this point, we don't want just Swaraj, which is independence, but we want complete independence or Purna Swaraj. So that was the first time India declared its complete independence. So it was all the Punjab revolt, etc. They were all linked to tax, or they were propelled by tax, but they were all linked to the Quit India movement by then.
And it wasn't, so this wasn't, when you say direct, all linked to tax, I have in front of me right now this Declaration of Independence of the Indian National Congress. The second paragraph literally is all about taxes. It says, India has been ruined economically. The revenue derived from our people is out of all proportion to our income. Our average income is 7p, I don't know what that means, less than 2p per day. And the heavy taxes we pay, it's the salt tax, like it's really right there in the Declaration of Independence, all about taxes, the second paragraph. And so there's this whole protest. So then how did that move into, last I checked, India was not the UK anymore. So how did the separation actually happen, go moving from tax resistance and the salt march to actual independence?
The tax resistance continued. And in fact, there are several quotations from Churchill that said that subjugation of Indians on the matter of tax, even after the salt march, actually established the fact that what I have already said, that Indians can be subjugated and they can be subjected to tax. So, I mean, I have some quotations here, but I won't tell you the little short quotations unless you want them. But the basic thing is that the general thinking, even at the very top of the government, not just in India House, that is the India government based in Delhi, but also the UK government based in London, by then was very much that India has to pay tax, and no one ever thought from their side that the colonial regime is coming to an end. And I think the reason it transmuted into the Indian independence movement was that, firstly, the salt march and the 100,000 arrests and all the, you know, beating up of the peaceful demonstrators, because Gandhi's policy was satyagraha or nonviolence, that was covered by international media in the UK and the US. So it got global coverage, and it began to be critiqued and criticized in Western societies. And that was the first time it happened to that extent. And the reality of India, and of course, they also covered poverty and so on and so forth, etc. The reality of India was flashed to the Western public to that extent for the first time. And so the independence movement, as a result, got impetus through the salt mark. And UK historians and American historians, several of them said to the effect that that was one of the last nails on the coffin of the British Raj. So that is why the link. And by 1930s, clearly the Indian National Congress was talking about self-rule and so on and so forth. And there were a couple of Indian representatives in Indian Parliament, and they were also whispering the possibilities. And then there were, and by the way, the elite of India were being educated in Eton and Harrow and Cambridge and Oxford and London School of Economics and Fabian Socialism and so on and so forth. So they had been coming back over the previous century from Britain with all these ideas. So all of that also propelled the idea of independence by then. The as you have commented, the salt lack was sort of like a catalyst for that. But the independence movement was moving independently, and salt march occurred because Gandhi thought that would be a tremendous indicator, metaphor for whatever was to happen, and they came together as a as an instrument. So salt march became an instrument for the independence.
And so the independence was 1947?
Yes.
That right? And then, and the salt tax was sort of still around for a few more years, but eventually under after independence was...
That's right. The salt march, the salt tax was still around, and that it, it was abolished just around the time of independence. It stayed on, yeah. Yeah,
slightly after.
So I do think it's a kind of a fabulous story about how, you know, taxes really do connect the governed to the government, and if you're unhappy, you taxes will often play a role in that unhappiness, as we see in many countries. We just talked about with India.
In America, we threw all the tea in the sea.
Tea went into the harbor. Yeah,
the tea went into the harbor, and then we fought a war, and then we became independent from the same oppressive rulers.
It's but,
darn all British. Back to those.
Yeah, and you know, yep. And you know, I'm sure that what was the Boston Tea Party? It was the East India Company.
Same company
came there, and several patriots in the U.S. wrote that beware if you let these thugs come into the U.S., we will be reduced to the same condition as what they did to Bengal.
Ah, interesting.
So there are very interesting comparisons, and so US at that time was very aware by then of what was happening to Bengal. So that was 1700s, and that was exactly the time of independence. But you know, the no tax or no amount of collection could ever be imposed in the US. Before, I mean, they really threw out this, I don't remember, I don't know, 7,000, 8,000 tons of tea into the Boston Harbor. And the British, East India Company fled. They couldn't extract anything. Yeah.
Yeah. So I would like you, I mean, you've had a number of kind of very important roles and have been exposed to a lot of different things that would let you opine on this. What can we learn, kind of to wrap up, what can we learn from this experience in India that's applicable to tax policy or tax administration today? Like, what are the takeaways? You've been at the IMF, you've been at these other kind of locations. What should we learn from this for today?
Well, you know, I think of it as two-pronged. One is we should not forget history, but we do. For example, in the UK, any reference to colonial rule has been wiped off from schools and colleges. There's no, literally no knowledge unless you specialize in that subject and you become an extremely scholarly person. there's no exposure. No one knows. No one literally knows.
Of course, our millions of UK listeners will hear this episode. And so that problem solved. So we got that
they
one
should,
done.
Therefore, I always say that they should introduce some of their history. And all you see is what are the benefits and that they were the benefactors there. They were in several matters, they were. But there was such a grief. So the thing is that wherever we go, we should not forget history. And that is so important for a man to learn or woman to learn.
Yeah.
And that is the first thing I feel from such egregious historical experiences in the 19th and 20th centuries that we should not forget. Second thing is coming directly to tax. And there I feel what one learns in terms of modern taxation is that tax should be sort of, here I did write down a couple of things which I think that, tax policy, firstly, is a very sensitive area of responsibility of government. So it cannot just extract. And in several emerging economies, I find that there is this tendency to extract. Or some advanced economies have very high marginal rates without equivalent benefits that go to society. So what one wonders, where is all the money going to? And so the fair, on top of that, whatever you collect, is there fairness, equity, caution, probity? Are these things there? Is there some kind of attempt at understanding horizontal equity and vertical equity and so on and so forth? And often, in many countries, if you look at the cross-section, there is no pattern of countries among advanced economies, emerging economies. They seem to have been going asymptotically towards a kind of commonality. And then from this century on, or slightly earlier, I think it just became very centrifugal. The patterns are disappearing. The other thing in emerging economies in particular, but sometimes in advanced economies as well, is that tax seems to be used for revenge. And, opposition people are pursued and so on and so forth as a policy, as a latent policy. And that is extremely dangerous. And it happens in so-called countries that are, admired for economic progress and so on and so forth. And finally, I feel that the tax administration should be subject to the law. There can be no impunity. And as you know, even in the US, the IRS has been called to Congress quite a few times to answer for the treatment of taxpayers. Similarly, in many emerging economies, it is not at all uncommon for tax administration to call taxpayers willy-nilly without giving the reason as to why that person is called. In the US or UK and European countries, there is less of a fear of being randomly called in that manner. At the same time, even in the UK, when I was chief economist in HMRC, I was there for 3 years, frankly, and we had a workshop, I remember, where everyone was given a brown envelope and asked, what do you think when you see a brown envelope from HMRC? So many people said, oh, you miss a heartbeat. And they were all HMRC employees. You miss a heartbeat because you think, oh my God, HMRC, what is it? And the workshop conductor said, that should not be the case. When you get a brown envelope from your tax department, you should not. So I think that these are very modern, ongoing, and never to dissipate lessons that we can learn from taxation history. It is the case in many countries. Taxation has never been something that people can forget. But in India, under colonial rule, it was very extreme. And so they may not have been income tax directly, but even the methods of extraction were extreme. And of course, income tax didn't really exist till the beginning of the, towards the beginning or second or third decade, second decade of the 1900s. And the US was the first one that introduced it for the war effort, as I recall.
Well, Partho, thank you so much for your insights and for talking to us about the very fascinating history of tax in India and your insights related to the lessons that can be learned from that fascinating history. So thank you for coming and chatting with Jeff and I today.
Thank you very much, both of you.
My name is Scott Dyring. I'm professor of accounting at Duke University, and I'm joined, as always, by my co-host at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, Jeff Hoops. Our guest today has been Parthe Shom, who, among other things, is the founder, chairman of the International Tax Research and Analysis Foundation, and has been all kinds of things, from a minister in the government of India to working at the International Monetary Fund and many other tax-related policy and think tanks. So thank you so much for joining us. We'll chat with you next time. Goodbye.
Goodbye.